WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The biggest crowd control maneuvers in European history are planned for June, when the European Soccer Championships begin in Sweden. Authorities will try to prevent soccer riots, which in the past have destroyed neighborhoods, terrorized people, and ended in death. In 1985, at the European Cup final in Belgium, fights between Italian and British fans ended in 39 deaths. In 1989, at an Association Cup semifinal in England, 95 fans were killed in a crush. My guest Bill Buford says he wanted to know why young males in England were rioting every Saturday at soccer matches. So he spent many weekends through the 1980s traveling with soccer hooligans. His new book, Among the Thugs, is about the experience and seduction of crowd violence. Buford is the editor of the literary magazine Granta. He's an American who lives in England. He told me what got him interested in following the rioters.
I saw a group of supporters when they were leaving a football match. In fact, it was more than a group. It was some Liverpool supporters who'd taken over a train, and the train was stopping for some police reinforcements. It was a small suburban Welsh station where everyone around me spoke Welsh, and I was waiting to get a train to London. And the absolute power of this group, the sort of the sheer excitement that they felt of knowing that the train was theirs and that they could do anything they wanted. They were taking apart the tables and with the legs of the tables trying to break the windows. And they were chanting over and over again, a very simple, rudimentary chant, Liverpool, la la la, Liverpool, la la la. But it was 400 or 500 people packed into this train. And I just found the power of the numbers awesome. And suddenly I realized that every Saturday there were a group of people who got together and behaved like a crowd and broke things and destroyed things and beat each other up. And I wanted to find out more. It didn't make sense to me that it was taken for granted in this way. I wanted to find out who these people were and what it was that was exciting them.
Well, if I asked you who were they, what could you tell me? I mean, as a group, is there a typical type of person who becomes one of the football thugs?
Well, if you're told that there's a group of young people, young males, 19 to 21, 22, 24 years old, in Britain, who get together and riot on a fairly routine basis, then you would probably assume, as certainly I assumed, that they're disenfranchised in some way, that these are the unemployed, that these are people without hope, that they are the disenfranchised. What I found, in fact, was exactly the opposite. They have jobs. Some of them work in banks. They're accountants. They work for British Telecom. They're painters. They're decorators. They're taxi drivers. They are the heart of the male working class, except that there really isn't a working class anymore in Britain. They're the children of the working class. They're sort of the new consumer suburban generation of Britain.
As you point out in your book, crowds and riots are often portrayed from the victim's point of view, and you tried to capture what it's like to just be a part of that crowd, not the victim of the crowd. The expression that's used in the soccer riots is "it's going off" when things are about to explode. Can you give us a sense of what it feels like when it's going off?
Yeah. So one of the things I discovered is that in the whole history of crowd violence, most people write about it from the outside. They don't write about it from the inside. They write about it as someone who's reading about it, or somebody who's on the balcony when the crowd comes charging down the street, or somebody who is one of its unfortunate victims. I ended up being in a rather privileged position of being with a group of people who work themselves up into such a state that they could very self-consciously cross that threshold of civilized conduct to become members of a crowd. And I saw it again and again and again. And there are a number of illusions or fallacies, really, about crowd violence, which I think come because most people look at the crowd from the outside. And one of the fallacies is that a crowd is mindless, or a crowd needs a leader, as if people really wouldn't behave as rationally as they do in a crowd unless someone else made them do that. What I found is that this is a group of people who knew that they had to reach almost a special kind of state. They had to work themselves up into a special kind of state to be able to cross that border of civilized conduct. And there might be, I'm speaking to you from London, and it wasn't far from here that I was at a Chelsea match. Chelsea is one of the South London teams, when the team that I was following, Manchester United, came down for a big game. And afterwards, the supporters would slip out one by one. They'd slip out past the police protection, and they would start to form a group and realize that they were forming a group. And then this very sense of they're forming a group gave them a kind of power. It gave them a strength that they didn't have. And as more and more people got together, the group itself got stronger and stronger, and they would start to chant, to work themselves up into this state where they could cross that threshold of civilized conduct. And there's that moment when they can tell that they're about to cross the threshold. And that's when this phrase recurs: it's going to go off, it's going to go off, it's going to go off, meaning it's going to explode, or it's going to be out of control, or everyone will no longer be individuals anymore. They will be members of the crowd. It's going to go off, it's going to go off, and then finally something happens. Usually something physical, glass breaks, or somebody breaks a piece of property, or somebody smashes a car. Usually it's some item of property. And this sense of containment, of being civilized, this respect for the law, is obliterated in an instant.
You know, one of the things you say is that what you hadn't expected was that the violence would be so pleasurable. You say there was an intense energy about it. It was impossible not to feel some of the thrill. Would you explain that, what you were feeling?
It's the thrill of adrenaline excitement. You've got a group of people who are setting out to inflict injury on people, who are setting out to make violence. And there's enormous anticipation, there's preparation, there's the expectation of violence. Finally, the act of violence itself is spectacularly full. It's a very, very full moment. It's a moment of danger, excitement, fear. It's an animal moment, an adrenaline moment, an instinct moment, when you are as concentrated into the present tense as you could possibly be. There's no future, there's no past, there's no reflection. There's nothing mediating between you and the experience.
Now, in one riot you were in, I think it was the last riot you were in Italy, there was a big march that turned into a riot, and you ended up being clubbed by the police. Let's start with the march. What kind of march was this supposed to be? Why a march?
I still can't figure out why a march. The Italian authorities were so terrified of the England supporters that they went out of their way to make the England supporters' time absolutely miserable. And I think the march was this bizarre, spontaneous display of English solidarity. They just wanted to prove that they could be a crowd. And a game that was meant to start at 9 o'clock in the evening, suddenly everybody was marching for the game at 6 o'clock in the evening. It was just a bizarre, spontaneous protest, and 4,000 people took over the city and started marching to the game.
What happened when the police moved in? How did the Italian police respond to the riot?
They moved in with lots of people and guns and tear gas and all the things that provokes an English lad, I think. Finally, at the end of it, the Italian police retreated, and the England supporters, who had been very quiet all day, they hadn't been drinking, they hadn't been chanting, they hadn't been singing, broke out in this chant for England. England, England, England. Not knowing that if the Italian police were retreating, they were retreating because they were going to snap back in some fashion. And I was just waiting for them to snap back. I was convinced they were going to come chasing after us. And within minutes, they did, as tear gas rained down on everybody's head. And I sprinted ahead of the pack and ran up a hill, determined to get away from them, only to discover that we were trapped and that on the other side of the hill there were 2,000, a very large number of Italian police waiting for the England supporters. And they thought, I think, that I was one of the leaders.
Why would they think
and
that?
And I could see that I think because I was the first one over the hill. And in my determination to get away from the Italian police, I ended up getting to the front of the pack, and so that I was seen to be one of the leaders. I was certainly dressed like one of them. I should note that the place was, there was almost as many journalists as there were police, because everybody was there for the England supporters to behave badly, but I wasn't wearing journalist credentials so that I could mix with the supporters comfortably. And I didn't have the big, heavy yellow tags that say that you're press. And I could see that there was nothing I was going to be able to do, and I got down on my hands and knees and hid between two cars. Police behind me, police in front of me, and no way out, only to be severely beaten up by three policemen who then surrounded me and then just thwacked me endlessly, one going at my kidney and one going at my head and one trying to reach my collarbone.
And they hit you many, many times. And in describing that in your book, you say that you were both experiencing the pain and thinking about how to describe it because you knew that this was something you'd have to write about.
I had a different experience from the others. They were actually extremely violent. I have never seen so much hatred concentrated in a person's face as I found in the face of those Italian police when they came charging up the hill. I knew there was no way that I could start squealing giornalista to stop them from beating me up. It was just concentrated physical hatred, and the supporters around me were really quite badly injured. There was a lot of broken legs and a lot of blood and a lot of cracked foreheads, and it was a little nationalistic battle. But it was also, I have to say, my experience of it was different because I was writing about it. The other supporters were getting beaten up, and they just hurt. I was getting beaten up and hurt, but also knew that I had the chance to end my book.
Right. You had a climax. And how did being beaten by the police in Italy change your grasp or your view of what the riots are about? Did it?
I don't think it did. It offered a slightly different perspective. I mean, I had been out to describe violence, and I was describing violence by being close to it. And now I was in a position where I could describe violence by being the object of it. What was interesting to me about that Italian experience was how much it was informed by nationalism. Just stupid, stupid, crude, masculine nationalism of a sort that made no sense whatever, and of a sort that looked like it was never, ever going to go away. It was just an enduring feature of male culture. The England supporters really wanted a war, and it didn't matter that it was the Italian police, though they're quite happy to fight the Italian police. It could have been the Dutch supporters. It could have been Dutch police. It could have been Russians. It could have been Romanians. They wanted a war. They wanted to defend their idea of England. They wanted to defend the Queen and the Union Jack and the Bulldog and all the people back home, even though all the people back home would really be quite happy for the supporters to be put in prison and the key thrown away.
My guest is Bill Buford, author of a new book about soccer riots. He's also the editor of the literary magazine Granta. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Buford, author of Among the Thugs, The Experience and the Seduction of Crowd Violence. I'm interested in something that happened to you after being in one of the soccer riots. You were going back home and you were getting onto the subway, lots of stairs that you had to get through to get to the train, which you were afraid you were going to miss. And you encountered on the stairs, you were really in a hurry, you encountered two elderly people, a couple, I think one of them used a cane, they were walking very slowly. You were so impatient that you pushed them aside and cursed them, which is the kind of behavior that is very out of character for you. But it sounds like some of the spirit of the soccer thugs was lingering. What came over you?
This was after I'd spent, I suppose, 3 days with the Manchester United supporters, and my whole point was that I was infiltrating the group and being with them, getting to know them. I wasn't pulling out my notebook. I was drinking with them, talking with them, being as close to the violence as I possibly could when there was violence. And when I came back feeling gritty and nasty and dirty and obviously much more influenced by them than I realized, I had taken on their code of rudeness. There's this, the supporters pride themselves on their anti-civilizing, rude conduct, where any rule is a rule to be broken, any social nicety is a nicety to ignore, and in fact they make a point of being as offensive and as rude as they possibly could, and this had influenced me to the extent that when I shoved these old people aside, I was really making a point of being rude to them. I think I got too close to my subject.
Did you scare yourself?
No. I don't think I've got very high moral expectations of myself.
Okay.
I was interested. I was intrigued by it. I was intrigued by myself as sort of I became my own subject in some ways.
The European Championships will be held this month in Sweden, and Europe is preparing for the biggest crowd control maneuvers in the history of Europe. What are they planning? What can you tell us about what's being planned to prevent riots at the soccer championship?
Oh, I'd love to know what they're planning. They're obviously these pretty Swedish towns and cities are preparing for the spectacle of marauding supporters, drunk and smelling and stripped of their clothing, running through their streets, chanting, breaking windows and turning over cars and beating each other up. And what they're planning is how to contain that prospect. And I would love to know how they're going to do it. The English police have been advising them, and the English police are very good at controlling crowds. There's an established history, I suppose, of crowd violence, which has resulted in this very refined police tactics, which rest mainly on animals. By using dogs and horses, the England police have got very good at containing crowds. I've been able to see the way that different police in different countries do it. The Italian police are the worst. The German police are quite efficient, but not all that good. And I think the Swedish police at the moment are completely terrified.
Why are the Italian police the worst?
They do it with numbers. And they do it by overarming themselves. Mm-hmm. They have bazookas and submachine guns and military helicopters, which, if used, presuppose that actually they would be slaughtering hundreds of football supporters. And the football supporters know they're not going to be, you know, hundreds of them are going to get killed. So it's useless armaments. In the World Cup, they were firing guns in the air, and I think that was meant to terrify people into believing that maybe they'd get shot, and it had exactly the opposite effect. It somehow insulted them. So then they all charged the man with the gun. It's completely insane conduct on both parts, to my mind.
Do you think that there is a leadership within the group of violent soccer fans, or is it just a disorganized group thing?
Both, I think. The commonplace perception about crowds is that they have leaders. And this is commonplace because, in fact, they do have leaders. But what isn't true is that leaders make crowds. Whenever there's a crowd riot, there's always a great effort to arrest the leaders, as if they take the blame for the irrational conduct of all the people in the crowd. After the poll tax riot, Margaret Thatcher was determined to find the leaders. And after the Milltown Cemetery riots, where two soldiers were pulled out of their cars, beaten and killed, again, the government was determined to find the leaders. But what I found in my experience is that a crowd makes itself. The people in a crowd know what they're doing. They know the power they suddenly have by being numbers. And crowds make leaders possible. They need leaders. They're happy for leaders. They want to be led. They want to be directed. But whenever you see someone try to lead a crowd that's not going to be a crowd, the crowd refuses to follow, refuses to obey.
Have you ever been in the middle of a political riot?
I've been in the middle of political protests that became quite violent, usually involving the police.
Yeah. How did it feel different than what you experienced with the soccer thugs?
The soccer thugs was more intended, in that the objective was to get to that moment of crowd frenzy, or the objective was to get to the moment of crowd violence. I mean, I made a point of actually trying to go to as many riots as a boy could. There aren't generally that many riots on offer, but there was the British coal strike in the early 80s. There was a great industrial disputes involving the Times in South London at Wapping. And I tried to go to a lot of these just to see how the crowds behaved and who was leading them and whether there was a shared excitement about violence, if actually people there got a thrill out of it, if they enjoyed it in the way that the football supporters did. And I think they do, in the same way that I think that the riots in Los Angeles involved a lot of people who enjoyed rioting, enjoyed looting, enjoyed breaking the law. But the difference is that these people know what they're doing. They know what it takes to reach that frenzied state to become a crowd. They know the power of the crowd, and they've had the adrenaline, excitement, and the kick in the past, and they want it again. So it's much more intended. I think in most cases of crowd violence, people in a crowd suddenly discover they are a crowd and discover that power and that excitement. And it's arbitrary and almost impossible to predict, whereas these people know it, and they want it again.
Do you still go to soccer games?
Yes, cautiously. And actually, I'm still in touch with quite a lot of the supporters. One in particular has decided he wants to go straight, that he's tired of violence, crime, and making money illegally, tired of going to jail, and now wants to become a normal human being, but he'd still like to have a great deal of money if that's possible. And he thinks that I'm going to be his guide to this for some reason. But in the course of this, actually, I've discovered the sport, and I enjoy it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Buford is the author of Among the Thugs. He's also the editor of the literary magazine Granta. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.